Good afternoon, and welcome to the regular briefing on COVID-19 by Lieutenant Governor Polito and members of the Baker Polito administration for the municipal chief executive officers of the cities and towns of Massachusetts. Since the beginning of the pandemic, a Lieutenant Governor and their team has been meeting regularly with you at this a particular forum to share real-time information and work in collaboration and partnership with you. And we're very pleased that as 2021 continues and the next phase of fighting the pandemic continues, the administration's partnership with you is stronger than ever. I do want to, again, Jeff Beckwith, Executive Director of the MMA, want to extend our appreciation to all of you who are at the MMA's annual meeting. We are going to hear first from Lieutenant Governor, and then from Senior Associate Commissioner Russell Johnston on pooled testing. We'll have a brief update from Heath Failey and the finance team on the latest in municipal finance, and then plenty of time for questions of the administration. So, and that will be, the answers will be led by the Lieutenant Governor. So Lieutenant Governor Polito, thank you again for being at the opening session of our annual meeting. Thank you for announcing the increase in unrestricted general government aid and for your community one-stop for growth program that you announced. And thank you again, of course, for your leadership on COVID-19 in the joint local state response. Lieutenant Governor.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. It's an honor to be with you here. Once again, I won't go through the team that we have lined up for you today as Jeff just did that, but I do wanna just start by saying congratulations on a successful virtual MMA annual conference. I know we all miss being there in person. I was just saying before hopping on here how much I loved, as the governor did too, go into that packed room at the convention and then head down to the floor to see all the exhibits and be so close to all of you. We will do that again and we will look forward to that. But great job in running the MMA conference. We were delighted to be a part of that. I want to start by giving you an update on vaccine distribution. And I anticipate that there are many questions on your minds on this particular subject area. And while we have Heath and Russell giving updates as well, we want to leave ample amount of time to address your questions and many of the questions you might have around the vaccine distribution. And Jana Ferguson is joining me to address the questions as best we can today. So let's get started. Since Saturday, 439,828 doses of vaccine have been administered for phase one. Over 247,000 doses have been administered to healthcare workers. Over 86,000 doses have been administered in long-term care through the Federal Pharmacy Partnership Program, 23,000 doses to first responders. Thank you to the local boards of health. Many of you have set up VAX clinics for that purpose. Over 3,000 doses administered in correctional facilities and over 1,000 vaccines administered in commercial pharmacies. As of this week, we will have 103 publicly available VAX sites. These sites and other clinics for places like long-term care facilities, between these, we will have the capacity to administer 242 vaccines per week. By mid-February, and this is an important one, we expect to have 165 publicly available VAX sites to administer or capacity to administer 305,000 vaccines per week. So today, 242,000 VAX per week capacity, meaning having the ability to deliver that many of doses. And by mid-February, 305,000. So the important note here, our capacity and shots in the arm are not the same thing. Capacity means the sites, staff, and logistics in place to administer 305,000 doses per week. The 189,640 doses we are scheduled to get each week is less than what our capacity allows for administering. So that whole idea about if we build it, they will come, The part about they will come is a question, because it's the federal government that delivers those doses to the states and to our state. But we want to be ahead of it, right? And that's why we want to have the capacity throughout our Commonwealth, geographic diversity, and diversity within the urban areas to make sure that there is accessibility. And we will have this built out, and as I stated, to support 305,000 doses per week by mid-February. And we are hopeful that the federal government will be delivering the doses so that we can roll them right through the capacity that we will be lining up. So where are we now? mass.gov/COVID vaccine. That's where you direct people to find out when and where they can receive their vaccine. They go to the website. They can find when they are eligible to receive the vaccine based upon the phased-in approach that we've outlined with our vaccine advisory group here in, for our Commonwealth of Massachusetts. They can go to the website and find a site that is near and accessible to them. They can click on that site, and when they are eligible, they can make an appointment to receive the vaccine. Yesterday, so let's talk a little about the where, and you'll see the map that shows the where. We announced 7 mass vaccination sites, including ones that you are familiar with, Gillette and Fenway. The new sites include Springfield, the Eastfield Mall, which will be open January 29th. The Danvers at the DoubleTree Hotel, it will be February 3rd, and the Reggie Lewis Center will open the first week of February. So that's 5. And there are 2 additional sites that the COVID team is looking at to set up 7 mega sites. Eligible residents in phase 1 will be able to schedule appointments at these mega sites. The sites will begin vaccinating around 500 people per day, and some sites will ramp up to as many as 5,000 per day with a total weekly capacity of 76,000 per week by mid-February. Okay, so that's the volume that those mass vac sites will be able to deliver. Also listed on the map are public vaccination sites, including local pharmacies, community clinics, and other providers. They are marked on the vaccine map as public vaccine sites. Also on the map are restricted sites, and they're labeled as such because they're smaller scale operations operated by the community and limited to residents from certain cities and towns or dedicated to certain workers like first responders. They are yellow in the map. This builds on what we did last week around the pharmacy partnership. And yesterday, regarding the pharmacy partnership, we expanded that program, adding 43 new pharmacy and retail locations like the Big Y, Wegmans, Price Chopper, Hannaford, Stop and Shop, CVS. And by February 15th, we expect to have 71 retail pharmacy sites open across the Commonwealth. Last week, we announced the Hospital Depot initiative. That obviously continues to work, and it facilitates access to the vaccines for independent COVID-facing physician practices prioritized under phase 1 by identifying hospitals serving in each region of the state to serve as a depot. For clinical practices that are unable due to their staff size and storage capacity to receive larger director allocations of vaccine, a depot hospital will receive doses on their behalf. And we outlined the participants there, like Mass General, Lawrence General, Signature Brockton Hospital, UMass Memorial Center, Bay State, and Berkshire Medical. To reiterate, all members of phase 1 are eligible for vaccines. Regarding phase 2 of the vaccine distribution, we made some key updates and announcements yesterday. I'm going to go over those again. First, starting on February 1st, vaccines will begin for the first priority group in phase two, which is everyone over the age of 75. So tomorrow, that's January 27th, Wednesday, residents age 75 and older will be able to schedule an appointment for vaccination by consulting the vaccination site map, which again may be found at mass.gov/COVID vaccine. You may have additional questions about this. We have a specific FAQ that Elder Affairs distributed to your councils on aging. We can talk about that a little bit more and especially put the link up to that document so you can see like questions. I have older people in my community, they don't know how to access a website and make an appointment. What do we do? Those kinds of things we can help you with. Second, consistent with CDC guidelines, residents age 65 and older will be moved up in the order and start getting vaccinations after those who are 75 and older. So phase two, adults that are age 75 and older, then adults age 65 and older, and individuals with two comorbidities. Third, early education and K-12 workers, transit, utility, food and agriculture, sanitation, public works, and public health workers, and then individuals with one comorbidity. So that's a lot. It's a lot of good information, and we appreciate all of your efforts and partnership there. You're going to hear from Russell talk about the EEC testing program. With the pilot setting up testing sites in Athol, Braintree, Billerica, Dalton, Franklin, Plymouth, Sturbridge, and Westfield, continuing to explore additional testing locations, and $8 million in state and federal funds to stand up a PPP fulfillment process of 1 month's supply. Russell is available to talk about that further, as well as the pool testing. For surveillance purposes. All right, reopening. The good news is the COVID trends continue to move in the right direction. We are at 4.82 positivity. We haven't seen that rate since I think early December. Thank you, thank you, thank you for all of your good work and effort doing your part. As we see those numbers, the hospitalizations and the ICU numbers continue to trend in the right direction. The governor made an adjustment to our reopening strategy by peeling off the early closure and the stay-at-home advisory and keeping the 25% capacity limit in place until February 8th. We will obviously look at the data as we lead up to that and keep you up to date. The Small Business Relief Program, Mass Growth Capital grants keep coming in and going out. Weekly, we release more grants. We will have more releases this week, toward the end of the week. Right now, we're somewhere north of $232 million out the door, out of the $720 million. That's close to 5,000 businesses that have received grants to cover 3 months of their expenses. And to make sure that we continue to plan and prepare for our future and growth in your downtowns and main streets and expand our economy all throughout the Commonwealth. We have the one-stop program. There will be a webinar that Secretary Keneally and I will be hosting with you tomorrow at 10 a.m. The one-stop program, which consolidates 10 of our key partner funding buckets, is really born out of a lot of the conversations that we've had with you, making it even easier for you as a community to strategize around your economy and how you can access more of our state dollars to accelerate the pace of growth in your city or town. So with that, I'm going to conclude and turn it over to Russell to briefly talk about the testing initiative.
Thanks so much, Lieutenant Governor. Really glad to be with you here today to talk about our testing initiatives in the state, particularly the pooled testing that DESE is launching. And I can briefly mention the EEC initiative that was announced yesterday I do want to mention that my talking about a public health initiative in front of Jenna and Dr. Madoff is makes me feel like showing off my skiing skills in front of, you know, Franz Klammer or, you know, any of the gold medalists. So bear with me as I find my stride to talk about an important public health initiative in our schools. So let's talk about the why. Why are we doing this? Why are we bringing pooled testing as an initiative to our public schools, charter schools, approved special education schools, and education collaboratives? What's important to know about this is that, you know, we feel very strongly that the mitigation strategies that we have been using all throughout this school year, the hand washing, the physical distancing, mask wearing, staying home if you're sick, are very effective. Those are our core mitigation strategies. But as additional mitigation strategies become available, we're really glad to make sure that we're investing in them. And pooled testing is now more readily available at a kind of scalable level across the state than ever before. So we're really pleased that labs that we have here in Massachusetts, like Ginkgo and the Broad, are making themselves available to have the lab capacity, have the technology, that we can actually make pooled testing happen in our K-12 locations all across the state starting now. And we're really excited about that. Also, there is funding available. So the additional stimulus funding that's coming for schools and districts, we think will be really key to making this happen. And the final variable that's very much contributing to the success and why we can do this now is frankly that there are districts across the state that have already started to implement pooled testing. So we really appreciate what we've been able to learn from Salem Public Schools, Wellesley Public Schools, districts that have been doing their own research like Medway, just to name a few that have really decided that this is something that they want to know more about, that they've been investing in. We've been able to learn from them so that we can bring their ideas to scale across the state. So that's a quick background on why we're doing this. Let's talk about what we're doing. What we are doing is launching a 6-week early launch for any school or district that wants to participate in pooled testing at no cost during that 6-week period. We anticipate that the 6-week period will go from early February, we're saying mainly a start on February 8th, through March 28th. And so if you look at the calendar, that's slightly more than 6 weeks. Keep in mind that we have February break. And so we do get cleanly to 6 weeks when we go from February 8th to the end of March. And what we're really hoping is that through the state funding that, we can get as many schools and districts going as possible so that we are able to kind of pick up momentum and implement this additional mitigation strategy during that time period. The state will also, though, in the coming days, release our request for responses in order to set up a statewide contract so that once that 6-week period comes to an end, schools and districts can continue to work, you know, presumably with the vendors that we help them to get started with here in February and March, that they will be able to continue those services using their stimulus funds from April through early June when school dismisses for this school year. So by my calculation, that's about 10 weeks of school that the districts would be paying for this year, 6 weeks that the state would be paying for to get us started. And so, you know, we really feel like we have a strong model. We've been investing a lot in providing information to schools and districts. I'm literally coming to you directly from a webinar that we just ran today for interested schools or districts that wanted to know more about using BiNext Now. So here's an important component of the what of what we're doing. We are setting up pooled testing with vendors that I'll mention in just a minute. But we're really pleased that the Baker-Polito administration has prioritized schools for the use of Abbott Labs BiNext Now rapid antigen test that we, our colleagues at DPH, have shown through studies that they've been able to conduct here in Massachusetts, particularly and specifically at Lawrence General, that it's a very effective follow-up test. This is a very effective way for us to identify who from within a pool, if it's positive, might then individually be positively identified for having COVID. And it was really gratifying to have Dr. Smole, who runs our state labs, Dr. Katie Brown, who is our state epidemiologist, just really bring facts to and information and knowledge to our school and district leaders to hopefully help them feel very confident about using BiNext Now, this card-based rapid antigen test that we get results back in 15 minutes. We don't want students and teachers being unnecessarily kept out of school if there's worry that there's a, you know, who might that positive individual be from within a pool. So, you know, that's really the what we're doing. We're setting up this 6-week early launch where we're paying for the operational costs. We are paying for any additional costs that districts might need. such as, you know, having on-site administration or district-wide coordination of pool testing. We're saying as much as possible, we hope that those services can be found, those personnel to do that can be found within a district. But if it can't, we don't want that to be a hurdle or reason why a school or district can't start pool testing now. So 6-week launch at no cost, really trying to cover all of our bases with to make this possible for our schools or districts. Let's talk about the who will be involved. We have three vendors that we're really pleased to connect with and contract with for these services. They are CIC Health, Ginkgo, and Project Beacon. And so all three are coming in at a very similar cost. When we think about the cost of this initiative, the main factor is just the cost of the individual swabbing that has to happen once a week for students and staff, for anyone in a school. We want everyone in a school, if you're participating, we want every child in the school, every staff member, the bus drivers, everyone to participate. We're talking about a range from $3 to $5 per swab. We think that's really reasonable in terms of the cost of, you know, having ongoing surveillance COVID testing in our schools. A $3 to $5 cost seems something that feels doable in most locations. Maybe not all, but really making this as available as possible throughout the state and really relying on the stimulus funds. So let's finally talk about the when. So what we've been reminding schools and districts is that if they provide their information to us, which constitutes a statement of assurances and an application by this Thursday, they will be prioritized for as early a launch as possible. We'd like to see some schools and districts, frankly, get started next week, with most coming online by February 8th. So we're really excited about having the vendors, the level of interest. We had over 300 schools and districts that expressed initial interest to us, and we've continually followed up with them to get them ready, hopefully hear from as many of them by Thursday, and then get them started as early in February as possible with this exciting initiative. As mayors, the one thing that I want you to maybe take away from this is, if you're still wondering about it, if you're still not quite decided if this is right for your community, just know that we're not being bureaucratic about this. We want you to participate. So if you decide to come along a little bit later in early February and tell us you're ready, you want to get going, we'll take you then. So it's not too late to sign up. It won't be too late to sign up until just about early March. You know, at that point, you know, with the time that it takes to come on board, we would say, you know, mainly just wait and go ahead and use our state contract list to procure these services. But you have at least a month to decide if this is right for you. We want you to bring us your questions. Feel free to reach out to me personally. I'll make sure that either I or a member of my team get back to you in a timely way to get the information that you need. So glad to turn it back over to you, Jeff. The early child EEC testing as well. I apologize. So we did announce yesterday, and I just want to be clear that, I'm a DESE representative, and so I don't mean to steal thunder from our EEC colleagues. But yesterday we did announce that we have 8 locations throughout the state that will be drive-up testing sites that will be available for early childhood care providers and individuals affiliated with those programs. And EEC is dedicating $8 million in state and federal funds to purchase PPE to be able to support this effort. And we're really excited about what this will mean for our early childhood providers as well. So with that, I'll turn it back over to you, Jeff.
Thanks for that. Russell, I will before we go to questions, see if Heath Failey, the ANF Special Director of Federal Funds, longest title in state government, or Sean Cronin have a brief update, and then we'll go to the question and answer period.
Thanks, Jeff. I just want to flag one thing for folks. Again, Heath Failey, ANF Federal Funds Office. Wanted to flag that last week on Thursday, the president signed an executive order that instructed FEMA to increase the reimbursement rate associated with certain costs to 100%. So typically FEMA PA reimburses at 75% for most costs. We are still waiting for more guidance about what the executive order is going to mean and how that's going to be interpreted by FEMA. But the takeaway appears to be that some of the costs, perhaps many of the costs that municipalities have incurred associated with the COVID-19 response will be eligible for FEMA PA reimbursement, and some of those costs will be eligible for the 100% reimbursement rather than 75%. Obviously, good news. Certainly, once we see the details, we'll be able to provide more guidance to people exactly what that means for them and how it interacts with the Coronavirus Relief Fund municipal program that we have offered to municipalities over the past several months. The other thing associated with that executive order that is of note, especially relevant to the vaccine distribution conversation, is that vaccination related costs will be reimbursed at 100%. So municipalities applying for vaccination-related costs, including admin costs associated with setting up sites, et cetera, will be reimbursed at 100%. The current guidance indicates that increased reimbursement rate will take effect or took effect on January 21st, last Thursday, the date that the executive order was signed into law, though there's some discussion about whether that will actually be made retroactive back to the beginning of the disaster declaration. So more to come on that as well, but certainly very good news for folks as we as we turn our attention to vaccine distribution. The executive order also prioritizes vaccine-related FEMA applications. So if you're putting in an application for vaccine-related expenses, you move to the front of the line. So another good piece of news to be aware of. Again, many more details to come, especially as FEMA issues further guidance to refine the knowledge base, but want to make folks aware of that there's significant movement underway as the new administration takes over and begins to change policy accordingly. So I'll turn it back over to you, Jeff.
Great. Thank you very much. And thank you to for the thorough updates. And we actually have questions for all of you, both on vaccines, on the testing, and on finance, and actually even a little on how to find out who gets the economic development, who's receiving the economic development grants and or the relief grants in people's communities. So we'll cover all of these in the next half hour. Again, please post your questions in the chat. We'll get to as many of them as we can. We are recording this, an audio recording of this briefing will be posted on the MMA website, along with a summary article capturing the questions and answers, and the appropriate links will also be reported. So we're transcribing, recording, and providing you with a synopsis of this discussion. We'll take these questions in order. I think they're bunched pretty much in order. The first question is on vaccines. A request, Mayor Tyer from Pittsfield is asking about whether additional vaccine clinic sites could be located in the North Adams, Great Barrington, Pittsfield region on the map. There's concern about that region of the state having adequate access.
So I actually was just on the phone with the Berkshire Public Health Coalition, and we got all the details that were needed in order to put those pins on the map. So they should be up by noon tomorrow.
Well, that is about as responsive a possible answer as one could ever get in a webinar. Mayor Tyer, you've set the record, and Jana Ferguson, the commissioner, you've set the record as well. Thank you.
That's terrific.
Do you anticipate that doctors' offices will be approved vaccine sites for their patients as an option in either the stage two or stage three?
I can speak to that. Yes, absolutely. That's definitely part of the plan going forward. The doctors' offices that currently offer vaccines will absolutely easily be able to enroll in the COVID vaccination program, and other providers can also sign up. There's very good guidance on how to go about that on our website, but we absolutely want to get vaccine into as many arms as possible, and practitioners, providers are going to be a key component of that.
Thank you, Dr. Madoff. And there's another question regarding the the feasibility and the desire to help people who are 75 and older actually register, set up appointments, and navigate the state website. There may be some that are that aren't comfortable using an online platform. So the questions are, for example, is it possible for there to be a registration process by phone? Is it possible for Council on Aging or other municipal staff to take the information and make appointments on behalf of individuals? And then later on, there was a question about what kind of information will seniors and eventually everyone else need in order to go and set up a vaccine appointment?
Okay. There is a one-page document that we probably should put a link to in the chat.
I think we can share that afterwards. I'm not sure that it's it was shared via email.
Okay. So it was shared by email with your local councils on aging, regional aging service access points. So for instance, if you need assistance, if you're unable to schedule an appointment online or would like assistance with scheduling, please contact one of the below organizations, which could include your local Council on Aging. But that's something that you will need to coordinate the volume of calls that might come with that. And I don't know if Jana, you have any thoughts about how that can happen. You know, we in the past have used like 211 as a system that can also take calls and direct people to the right places, or even maybe even secure appointments. That's in development. It is not available at this moment.
Thank you. Yeah, correct. Oh, I appreciate you saying that. That is absolutely something that's being discussed in terms of the 211 assistance. And the information that went out to the Council on Aging went out from the Mass Councils on Aging. So that is a way that people can actually, you know, get in touch with someone who may be less comfortable with the websites. They can absolutely help look for appointments that are convenient, and then help people register. Some of the information that will be needed will include, you know, the stuff that the demographic information that individual has. They'll need their name and et cetera. They'll need, if they have information about their insurance, which is helpful for billing, for the communities to bill on the other side, then that information can be either entered in manually at the vaccination site or scanned and uploaded if the person at the Council on Aging has the ability to do that. But this can also be done over the phone. So perhaps that person can just enter in some information about it on behalf of the residents. Certainly there are phone numbers to, if the Council on Aging, for example, wants to try to find a location at the nearest CVS, there's an 800 number right on those pharmacy pins that are on the map. And so they can call directly and help that individual register for appointment. So there are a lot of assistance, you know, opportunities being built into the system to help people who either don't have internet access or who are having a challenging time finding navigating the registration process. We absolutely want to make smooth access to vaccine as much as possible.
And if you have that that like one pager and just send that over to MMA, we can turn that into a linkable PDF and put it on our website. And so people, when reading the summary article, will be able to get access to it.
Okay.
The easiest way to distribute it to the participants on this call.
We'll do that.
Recognizing that may be updated on a regular basis based on, or something like that, on regular calls. And so whenever it's updated for us, we'll update the link. So thank you. There's concern with some questions regarding what a number of communities received in terms of notification because of the limited knowledge of how much vaccine will be available from the federal government, that communities themselves are being limited to potentially, or MCVBP municipalities are being limited to a maximum of 100 Moderna doses a week, for example. It's really hard for communities to set up clinics when there's such a limited supply of the vaccine, and also the time to that it takes to set them up, just creating a lot of confusion and concern municipally. Can you give a little more clarity about that?
Sure. So yes, on so for everybody, the MCVP is the Massachusetts COVID vaccine program. So these would be municipalities that have enrolled into the MCVP system to receive vaccine directly. Just for clarity of what that means. Some communities have been working regionally, for example, on their first responders and may not have received vaccine directly, and so therefore didn't get this notice because it went to kind of that lead community. So given the limits of vaccine that we are receiving from the federal government and the demand on vaccine in Massachusetts, we need to limit the vaccine that's available for any one channel of vaccine delivery. And for the local public health departments who were planning on standing up clinics, that's meant we had to work within a certain constraint of the number of doses, just like the other vaccination sites are limiting, have to work within a certain constraint. And it was really unfortunate. I did not like sending out that letter, but I had to let people know that, and this is partly for the reliability of understanding how many vaccines might be available. I had to let people know kind of where their limits were. So we took into consideration a number of factors, geographic proximity to a mass vaccination site, the health equity impacts of COVID and some of our hardest hit communities, and the types of capacity that had been identified for a community to do vaccine for clinics through February, as well as some other considerations, and also whether or not they're, for example, whether or not they could use Pfizer or Moderna. Through that kind of allocation decision, we let communities know what their limits would be for vaccine ordering. And that really was to help facilitate planning so they could fairly well relying on a number to plan for, because we were also hearing a lot of variability. They'd place an order, they would be allocated less just because of the constraints, and they felt like they couldn't plan. So if you know you're going to get a certain number, not everybody has 100. There are a few communities, like I said, who are receiving more because they're high impacted communities or because they're using Pfizer or they're working regionally with other groups. Everybody will have a sense of how many they can order up to that amount. It may not be what people want. I don't think any of us want to be limiting our vaccine availability, but it will give them the ability to say, like, one day a week or working within concentrated groups in their community to make sure that there's some vaccination, say, for homebound elders or something like that. So this is actually a way to help plan, even if it ultimately isn't the capacity that we would like to see in each of our municipalities. And I think that's, kind of consistent with what we're hoping for across Massachusetts. We're building capacity so we understand where we can get vaccine out, but we are very constrained right now by what the federal government has given Massachusetts.
And if the federal government's reliability and volume increases and changes, then that would impact the limits that you've established, presumably.
Yeah, in all of the different ways we can get vaccine out. I think we'd love to increase capacity to get our residents vaccinated. Absolutely.
Right. We can understand that the efficiency and effectiveness is that variability. If you overpromised and underdelivered, there'd be so much time canceling, rescheduling that would eat up essentially the work that you want to be doing to fight the pandemic. So that's not great news, but it's understandable. So thank you for that. I am checking regarding answering questions of citizens who are in phase two. If a community set up a clinic, or what is the process for people with two or more comorbidities? Verifying that. Are those individuals in the phase supposed to go and get it through the healthcare system where those medical records are available? I mean, I think there's concern on the part of a municipality about being able to verify that someone has two comorbidities and therefore is eligible, or is it a self-attestation process?
So there is a self-attestation process. I mean, people certainly can go to their primary care providers, and as Dr. Madoff mentioned, that's going to be an opportunity for people to get vaccinated. But there's a self-attestation process that's available. The form is already available on our website. It's being built into PrepMod, which is a system a lot of municipalities, for example, are using. The pharmacies also have an attestation being built into their registration process. And that will give an opportunity for people who are registering to sign under the penalties of perjury that they have the comorbidities or are otherwise eligible to receive vaccine. In cases of people who are over the age of 75, for example, they may be asked to provide ID, but at the same time, we want to eliminate again the barriers for people to get vaccine. So if somebody doesn't have, you know, documentation to suggest that they are over a certain age, but they have signed a self-attestation, we are really hoping that, you know, people will continue to be able to be vaccinated. We realize that is an honor system to some degree, but they are willing to sign under the penalties of perjury that they meet those eligibility requirements, then we would hope that vaccination clinic sites would accept them.
Thank you. And then last question before if we have time, we'll come back to vaccines. A question regarding how long you think that the next stage, next phase is going to last to deal with moving through 75 and older, 65 and older teachers and other public facing employees, and then the two comorbidities. Do you have an estimate based on the current length of time? Are we still on track for that April, I think, for the next phase to open?
Well, we can talk. I mean, the phase has us February, March, phase two. The phases that we outlined yesterday is what we are working within. I mean, that hasn't changed. Okay. Again, building out more capacity as we outlined earlier, and really need the federal government to release the supply so that we can meet the capacity that we set up and stay on track. And as more vaccines come online, come to market, we can do more. The J&J vaccine, that's a one dose vaccine, would have an enormous impact on everyone's rollout. So that clearly isn't factored into our plan because it's not available yet. But if that does come, that can certainly help a great deal.
Excellent, thank you. We appreciate that, and we appreciate the ever-evolving challenge that you have. And we know that you recognize that creates even more ever-evolving challenges as communities seek to be in rhythm with you and get what they need. We do have a few school-related questions, and we'll pepper Russell Johnston with those for a few minutes, and then I'll get to some finance questions. On school dollars that are coming, these are the federal funds. Can they be used to address learning and social gaps due to remote learning? Will there be incentives for summer programs targeting learning gaps and so on? Is that those federal funds flexible enough for those purposes?
So we do understand the federal funds to be very flexible, very similar to the first round of stimulus money that we received. I think a big difference is the amount of money. So if we think about what we received in the fall in the way of federal stimulus money for education, we're looking at a factor of about four times that amount. So certainly more funding, certainly flexible use. And as always, we want them to support this idea of how to accelerate, how to overcome learning loss, and frankly, provide as much in-person learning as possible.
Great, thank you. If we do the 6 weeks of pool testing, are we locked into continuing the testing under the contract? We'd like to do it for the 6 weeks while we work through vaccinations, but we don't have the funding to continue after that.
Yeah, great question. So again, I'm hoping the stimulus money will help to create that continuity of this initiative. But we will be matching with vendors primarily, you know, so that we can find economies of scale. So for example, I heard from a Berkshire superintendent over the weekend saying, I'd really like to make sure that we combine forces under one vendor across Berkshire County as much as possible, because even just the courier services could potentially cost less if they're done, you know, across multiple districts that would be sending their samples to the labs, for example, that are mainly located in Boston. So we will be doing this matching process here this week and next week and beyond. But after that, after the end of the 6-week early launch that we have initiated, districts will be able to decide, do they want to continue on with this? Do they want to stay with the same vendor that they are currently working with? The price that I quoted to you of the $3 to $5 per swab, keep in mind, I saw another question in the chat, that's a weekly cost, that's not a daily cost. So think about all staff, all students, once a week at that price range. We anticipate it'll be a similar price when we have our statewide contract for you to purchase off of, but it won't be the exact same cost structure because it's a different contract that we'll be using to set up for districts to purchase those services. And I'll put it in the chat, but we have a website where we have all this information, including a further breakdown of those costs. I think, you know, the $3 to $5 per swab is a good starting point, but there are some other costs associated, and they're all in a memo that we released last Friday. And so I'll put that in the chat in just a minute.
Okay, thank you. And then here's a question, not quite clear on the intent, but Desi, do you envision daily testing for everyone? If teachers and staff get vaccinated in phase two earlier than March, would you open up testing to parents and family members of children, since it's commonplace that spread is initiating out of the classroom and from the household?
You know, we actually haven't contemplated really either of those questions just yet in terms of would pool testing need to continue with staff once they're vaccinated. I would imagine it would, you know, just again, for that confidence, we'd want to make sure that we would follow this through for the remainder of the school year. But again, we'll defer to our colleagues in public health who will help us make that final decision. We definitely haven't contemplated expanding to families and other members of the community, predominantly because we're trying to keep this, you know, within the school community in terms of understanding what's happening within our schools. And I think that there are other, you know, testing mechanisms that we have, particularly for symptomatic individuals at the community level. And, you know, once we get to that point, districts will predominantly be purchasing those services. And I don't imagine that we'd be recommending to districts, given the limited amount of funding, given that we really want to use this for our knowledge of individuals within the schools, that we'd be recommending extending pooled services beyond the school community.
And who's the lead authority on COVID-19 cases relative to case identification, contact, and management in the schools? The local Board of Health or the school district?
And I think that Jen and I can take this one together. So I can start, and then Jen, feel free to chime in. In our protocols document that we released this summer and have updated, we describe that we need individuals who test positive to assist the school in its efforts around contact tracing and the local boards of health and the community contact tracing collaborative in their work as well. So it's definitely a shared process. I think some of it relates to capacity. But, you know, we envision that for contact tracing from with of, you know, thinking about that high school student moving through a building, that it's really we're recommending that the schools do that level of contact tracing. And then when we look at where that individual may have gone in the community, that's more falling under local board of health and the contact tracing collaborative. But Jenna, how would you build on that?
Absolutely. I see it as a partnership. The local health department actually has the legal authority to do the contact tracing. They sometimes work with the community tracing collaborative, the CTC, to do that. But the school has an extraordinarily important role here in helping identify, you know, where a student has been and who else might be in their classroom and considered a close contact. So this is absolutely necessary for people to have a close working relationship to help do this work.
Thank you. And then just a question about the process of accessing and making decisions about use of the federal education related funds that are being passed through to municipalities to the school district to be held in a fund. And our understanding is that those are available for expenditure without further appropriation? And is it the school board, the local school committee, that's the decider? Is it the superintendent? Who's the decider in terms of allocating those funds?
Yeah, you know, having been a superintendent, I will tell you that superintendents would definitely need to work with their school committees to decide the use of those funds. A key role of the school committee is to decide the budget. You know, it's one of very few authorities that the school committee has. And so where there are kind of focused authorities for the school committee, we would definitely want to make sure that there is, you know, a decision together about how to use those funds.
Great. Thank you. We have a few questions for Heath and Sean. Although before that, since it's a good news story about the grants, Lieutenant Governor, that are going out to local businesses as a part of your relief package that you announced and are implementing, is there a place, perhaps you can forward, someone can from your staff can forward to us a place where local officials can go to find out who the recipients of those grants are in their community so they can get a sense of whether or not funds are flowing in for relief for their downtowns?
Jeff, we can follow up on that. I believe HED has shared the list in the past with your team, and that can be distributed to municipal officials through MMA.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much. So let's see, a question, there was a FEMA question. Given FEMA's expansion of reimbursement rates, this is from the city of New Bedford, is there any thought to being given to opening up the eligibility criteria for the CRF funding from the original CARES Act? The state currently has some restrictions in place that exceed federal requirements, such as business assistance and certain capital equipment. So is it possible to broaden the allowable use of the CRF funds?
I would say the answer is maybe. I mean, I think there are, so for example, on the small business assistance side, the limiting factor there were the compliance and administrative related concerns, in which we've, you know, and that was part of the reason for doing the small business grant program that was alluded to earlier through Mass Growth Capital. Has done, you know, $700 million worth of grants to businesses. But I think it is fair to say that, and as we have said through the duration of the program, as the federal guidance changes in the, you know, related to both FEMA and to the Coronavirus Relief Fund, you know, we will adapt the municipal program accordingly to make sure that we're in compliance with what the federal government is looking for and to make it, you know, work most effectively for our local partners. So I think that it's definitely going to be an ongoing process, but one that we look forward to working with you on as we go forward.
Thank you for that. Here's an aside, and I don't see Janice's photo on. Maybe she just turned off her camera. We have during this session received some inquiries from local officials in the greater Lowell area and in the South Shore area asking for DPH's help in standing up additional vaccine clinic options in those regions as well. I just want to call that to your attention the same way the Berkshire issue was raised earlier.
So yeah, I appreciate that actually. This is great. I have information from the Greater Lowell collaboration that would like to offer vaccines up in that area. So they're just still getting together their details and providing that information to us so we can make sure that information is posted on the map. In addition, perhaps he's even on this call, there is a town administrator working on a regional collaboration in Plymouth County, so that I'm hoping we can help them get set up soon. And I think people who probably are working together really hard to get that quickly. I would also say the state is looking at several locations in the southeastern part of Massachusetts, particularly around the New Bedford, like Dartmouth area, for a mass vaccination site. So they're scouting those locations for things that meet the criteria in terms of like square footage, et cetera, easy access, and have already started looking at those and have been meeting with municipal officials in those areas to try to find those best locations. So they're looking at alternatives for that as well, and we're hoping that something like that will come online soon. In addition to supplementing the pharmacy locations, et cetera, that are being offered. And we did also prioritize in particular, just for those who are on the Cape, additional mass vaccination kind of opportunities in Barnstable County, because we also know how challenging it is to commute from that area of the state to other parts. So we really are looking for multiple, again, high volume sites to be held across the state. They may not be right in somebody's backyard, but they should be relatively accessible.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I know our members appreciate that, especially those that posted in the chat and asked the question. Thank you. Commissioner, question about finances. You had referenced Heath, our administrative costs for vaccines being reimbursable by FEMA. How about the salary costs that are attributed if a local employee is spending the day at a clinic? Is that person's daily salary also reimbursable?
Yeah, I think we're going to need to wait for further guidance from FEMA about exactly what they're going to reimburse for. I mean, today, you know, the executive order came out on Thursday, and then I think so far they've generated a sort of a 2-page high-level summary of what they expect to do with more detail to follow. I think questions at that level of specificity will be addressed as we go along here in the next days and weeks.
Great, thank you. I do see in the chat a number of communities just being concerned about the challenge of the local role of being the intermediary between elderly residents, seniors 75 and older, or even folks that are 65 and older, and being that bridge to getting them set up through the state system. So they're requests for additional information and maybe guidance to municipalities about how to navigate that if they want to reach out and find their senior citizen residents and make sure they have access, but then also be able to have a process that these individuals will be able to get connected to an appointment.
We will follow up with you, Jeff, and provide you with the materials that have been shared with Councils on Aging and other like providers as distributed by Elder Affairs. And as we further develop the 211 system, that will also be released to you as well.
Right, thank you. And let's see, so that's, we anticipate that there'll be a whole series of, there are more questions than answers, and we'll just, that's our job, is to help go back and forth and facilitate that process.
May I suggest, as there are more questions about vaccination process, that you compile them, Jeff, and we will get them from you and provide you with additional information as needed, and we can continue to flow that information through you to the members.
Absolutely, we'll do it, and we'll work to be as efficient as possible for you, as opposed to sending you 20 emails a day. We'll compile it and we'll share it and we'll get it back. So we appreciate it. Of course, some local officials are saying we need that federal stimulus money, and we know that you're helping to fight to get additional federal, not just relief money, but stimulus money to Massachusetts and to our communities. We appreciate that. There's just a question also about the system. If a community helps set someone up for an appointment, but then they go and they get their vaccine someplace else, how is the system itself going to reconcile so that communities aren't essentially left having made appointments, but then somebody goes to the local Walgreens and that appointment could be filled by someone else? But how's the database going to work?
Jan is going to make sure it all runs perfectly.
We are.
Jan, I don't know if you have an answer to that, but there is a rhythm to this.
We're really working on it as best as we possibly can. I know this is challenging for people.
Absolutely. We appreciate that. And we appreciate the constraint of just not having the supply that you would want to have, in order to, set up the system and have all aspects have what they need and set it to work. So you have a management issue as well that hopefully will get easier over time. So Lieutenant Governor, we've come to the end of the hour. We've covered almost every single question. Again, the ones that we haven't covered, we'll forward to your staff. I will say a couple of things for our members. Lieutenant Governor is into energy savings. So every once in a while, you'll see her reach back with some papers and try and wave back on the lights that go off automatically in her room. And that's also how you know Lieutenant Governor is alone in her office, because no one else off camera is waving. So we know that you're masking appropriately and also that you're saving electricity. But in the future, when the lights go off, since our members now know that's why you're doing it, you can just turn and wave and then go back.
And let there be light.
Right, exactly. Right. To all of the administration officials on this call, we want to express our appreciation. I did have a couple of announcements I want to share with all of the municipal CEOs. These are a couple of important announcements we want to share with you. One that just happened today is that the MMA is not the only municipal association in the country. We work in partnership with 48 other municipal associations, and we have close relationships. We have a very close relationship with the Georgia Municipal Association. And yesterday, they had Dr. Anthony Fauci for a special 30-minute session answering questions from municipal officials, just the kinds of questions that municipal officials would want to ask Tony Fauci. So
I think the MMA should sell tickets to that.
Well, instead, what we've done is
be a fundraiser for you.
That's right. But what we've taken is Georgia has provided us with a copy of Dr. Fauci's Q&A with municipal officials. Georgia, Massachusetts, same questions, same great answers. That's posted on the MMA website. You can get it, alas, for free, but you can get it for free by going to MMA.org. I want to give a shout out to MMA's great communications and membership team for putting that up so quickly. So if you want to see Dr. Fauci answer questions that you would ask, go to MMA.org. The other is that the MMA is participating in a national and in a Massachusetts-based a survey on the impact of COVID. The International City Managers Association and UMass Amherst, the Department of Economics is involved in a major national survey of the impact of COVID-19 on households. Candace Pierce, the Director of Communications and Membership, is going to shortly be sending out information to every municipal CEO with links to this national survey. And the MMA asks you to post it on your website, to push it out to organizations and groups. We need as many households to answer this so we can get great data on the impact of COVID and identify disparities and also ways that households have been helped. The second is that because of our great relationship with UMass Amherst, the MMA is working with the Department of Economics and the School of Public Policy at UMass Amherst, and we are doing a Massachusetts-based study on the impact of COVID-19 on municipal operations. An entire course is going to analyze the survey results and provide a report for that municipal officials and state officials can learn from and learn lessons from. And so we will also, MMA will be providing information and a link to this survey that we would want municipal officials to respond to. And then finally, because we want to have you with us as much as possible, please remember that there's a municipal CEO briefing on the Community One Stop for Growth program that Lieutenant Governor announced last week. That's tomorrow at 10 a.m. The link has been already sent out to all of the participants in this call. And we look forward to seeing Lieutenant Governor, Secretary Keneally, and you to learn more about that program tomorrow. And then, of course, we will be posting a recording of this webinar on the MMA website and a summary article as well. So Lieutenant Governor, that's a lot. I just turn it back to you for some final words today.
Thank you to the team, to all the members, and to you, Jeff, for bringing us together. If you are interested, the governor will be making a State of the Commonwealth address tonight at 7 p.m. Please listen in. And we again, on behalf of our entire administration, to yours, thank you, and look forward to our next visit.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. Yes, we're tuning in tonight, and we thank you for the partnership. Take care. Have a safe week, everyone.